Eva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from LendingTree with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2. We're online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us today. On the program this afternoon, we talk with two scientists about the causes of obesity. How do they answer the question, why are we getting fatter? Well, they say the answer lies in our success as a species. Our guests are biologists Michael Power and Jay Shulkin, authors of The Evolution of Obesity. For this book, they looked into the fields of biology, history, physiology, and medical science. They say the purpose of the book is not to prevent or cure obesity. They say it grew out of trying to understand the how and why of human obesity. In their words, without that understanding, attempts to modify obesity within individuals will be problematic, if not doomed to failure. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Michael Power is a senior research associate at the American College of Obstetrics, and gynecologists, and a research associate at the Smithsonian National Zoological Park. Jay Shulkin, co-author, is the director of the research department at the American College of Obstetricians, there I've got it, and gynecologists, and a research professor in Georgetown University's Department of Physiology and Biophysics. Their book, The Evolution of Obesity, is published by the Johns Hopkins Press. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Michael Power, Jay Shulkin, good to talk with you. How are the two of you?
Oh, thank you, Celeste. This is Mike Power. We're doing very well, and thank you very much for inviting us.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is Jay Shulkin. Glad to be here.
Okay. One of the things you say in the book that is important to think about, I think, here at the outset is the obesity epidemic is not about excess weight. It's about excess fat. So how is obesity measured?
Well, obviously, weight has a lot of different components to it. You can be heavy in a lot of different ways. And what affects health more than anything is going to be the amount of body fat you have. So basically, when we're talking about obesity, we're talking about the relative amount of fat on a body. And you obviously have to have some fat on your body. Fat is actually an important component of health and well-being. But you can have excess amount of fat, and fat, which is usually stored in adipose tissue is very endocrinologically active tissue. It means that it can upset your metabolism in various different ways. So if you're talking about how you measure obesity, the best way, of course, would be to measure the percentage of body fat. And there's lots of ways of doing that. The simplest method is what we call the body mass index, and that's a relative measure of your weight to your height. But of course, that can be confused with, you know, a person with large muscle mass will end up showing a very high basal body mass index, and that isn't necessarily unhealthy.
Okay. And maybe you would talk with us a little bit about adipose, what it is and its functions.
Adipose tissue is are the cells in your body that store most of the fat, not all the fat. There's other fat in other places, but adipose tissue is the main storage place for fat. And one of its main, and that's actually one of its basic functions. Its function is to store fat. And you store fat for several different reasons. In one case, fat is actually toxic and unhealthy if it gets into other cells. So fat's always coming into the system. Often it's being metabolized in cells. That's no problem. But you don't want fat accumulating in your muscle cells or accumulating in your liver cells or accumulating in your skin cells. The fat basically gets preferentially dumped into your adipose tissue. So it serves a protective function, a place to safely store fat.
All right.
Jay, you want to make any comments?
That's fine.
Okay. Should I continue on and expound a little on that?
Sure.
Because the other then comes into the fact that fat is a very useful thing in your body in terms of energy, in terms of metabolism. So therefore, adipose tissue becomes a main place for you to store energy. So when you sit down and eat a meal, you're not eating the amount of food you're going to use in the next 10 minutes or 15 minutes. You're eating an amount of food that you're going to use over an extended period of time. Okay? But that energy from that food needs to be stored in some safe place to be used over that time. And the adipose tissue then becomes a very important place. It's not the only place it's stored. You store glycogen, which is the sugar form of energy, in your liver and your muscle. Adipose is where you store the fat, which is a great energy store.
Oh. Obesity is not new, but what is new is that there's so much obesity in the world today that there are countries where now up to one-third of the population is obese. How recent is this phenomenon?
It's a very recent phenomenon, Celeste. Basically, over the last few tens of years, we've seen the major increase. If you go back hundreds of years ago, you of course will always, as you say, there have been obese people, and in fact, looks like representations back tens of thousands of years, there were probably small numbers of obese people amongst the human populations. But in general, until fairly recently, the human beings didn't seem to have the capability to get obese, in other words, to be able to obtain so many calories from their environment and expend so little calories in their environment that they could actually get to an obese state. So it's really, it's been obviously increasing since in the developed world, the United States, say, from the early 1900s, but it really didn't start happening to a large extent until probably after in the 1980s, 1990s, and therefore. And in fact, at this point, it may be somewhat slowing down.
And although hunger continues to be a problem in some locations, this is a global phenomenon, and you say it affects men and women, young and old, rich and poor, from every race and ethnicity. So why has this happened so recently, and why are we seeing it in so many places around the world?
Well, the main sort of theme from in our book is that much of what we see in human obesity represents what was adaptive, normal biology now in a modern circumstance that doesn't match the circumstances in which that biology evolved. So if you look at adaptations, and adaptations are evolved characteristics, and the characteristics that through natural selection have accumulated in a population, things that happen. Adaptations are solutions to problems of your past ancestors. Right? Evolution doesn't work on the here and now. Evolution is the result of the past. So we have adaptations to problems and challenges that our ancestors faced. The problem we're now facing is that the environment that we live in is very, very different from the environment that our ancestors lived in. And so in many cases, many of these adaptations, while very appropriate 500 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago or more, are not as appropriate now because they're not facing the same circumstances.
Yeah.
I mean, our ancestors didn't have the glut of endless junk food, most of which do not serve nutritional value. And yet the hormonal systems to conserve and redistribute predominate the way the brain would evolve to absorb and redistribute food resources. Mm. There was no opportunity to glut. That's a modern era phenomena.
So in one case, what we're saying is that there are biological things within human beings, a lot of biological variation in human beings. Human beings are very variable, and obviously we see that because even in this modern environment, not everybody has become obese. I mean, one of the arguments I often hear is, if this evolutionary argument is so strong and so good, why aren't we all suddenly now obese?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, there's huge amounts of variation in the human population. Part of the situation is that a lot of that variation that causes or tends to encourage people to gain weight could never be expressed in the past.
Right.
You just couldn't get that much food from your environment in the past. And even if you could, you had to work so hard to get it that you would never accumulate that much extra fat. We've basically made that easy now, so a larger number, basically some of this biology is now being expressed. Well, in the past, it just was simply invisible.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests today are two biologists, Mike Power and Jay Shulkin. Together, they are the authors of The Evolution of Obesity. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Let's go and take that call. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, I've got a question about, and this may not apply, so if it doesn't, I'm sorry, cholesterols. And lots of talk now about all the things that they said about good cholesterol and bad cholesterol that have turned out not to be so true. And if this is part of the subject, could you address that?
This is Mike, and that's a clinician's question, so we're not exactly really well qualified to do that, but certainly cholesterol is a fat. It's a very important fat in the body. Cholesterol is necessary for a huge number of compounds that are in the body, so you have to have cholesterol. So obviously cholesterol is a necessary component of life. When they're talking about good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, it's sort of a relative term in there, and it talks about really excess in certain amounts and then how it affects the cardiovascular system. Certainly, there are associations with more fat on your body and higher circulating levels of cholesterol of all types. But that's really as far as I want to go on this issue.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for his call, and let's take another call. A listener in Monticello, Illinois. Line two, hi.
Good afternoon. I would like the guest to define what obese is. Is it a certain, what point in time are you considered obese? And I'll hang up and listen for the answer. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Again, there are lots of ways of defining obese. First thing I guess I want to emphasize is that the importance of considering obesity is considering it in health terms.
Yep.
Okay, it's a health issue. It's not that's the only issue we're dealing with here. Obesity in other ways, such as aesthetic terms and everything, that changes with culture, changes with time. But the important thing is in terms of health. And there, of course, dealing with your doctor is the best way to go about it, because while we do have basic statements such as if you look at a body mass index, again, that's your a relative measure of your weight to your height, if you're above what's called 30 in the body mass index scale, you are considered obese. If you're considered between 25 and 30, you're considered to be overweight. But that can vary quite a bit by the individual. And in terms of health, there are other factors that get into it. Obviously, just cardiovascular fitness, being physically fit, even if you have a high BMI, but if you're physically fit, you probably have a lower risk than someone who may have a lower BMI and not who is not physically fit. So Jay, you want to add on here?
Yeah, just want to add on, that's a very important point. I often go out to eat with a couple of friends, and the person who does the most exercise of us would be considered obese because of his body weight, if he just took body weight. But he rides his bicycle an hour each way into work. And so it's not just body weight per se. It's the whole lifestyle that's associated. And so so the body weight measure in and of itself, it can be misleading.
Okay. So while obesity is linked with a higher risk of mortality, being obese does not necessarily mean one is in poor health.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay.
A number of issues crop up. It's not surprising that the greater onset of type 2 diabetes, non-insulin dependent, is cropping up earlier and earlier, and it's almost always associated with people that are overweight. Now, that may be independent of the exercise issue, more dependent on the body weight issue for a situation like that, but that's only one of the modern dilemmas. That is type 2 diabetes and its intrinsic link to obesity.
And that actually comes to a certain extent on, once again, coming back to adipose tissue where your fat is stored. Adipose tissue has tremendous interactions with your metabolism and effects on your metabolism. It produces lots of hormones and other very active molecules that can affect and change your metabolism. So you have to think of your, in one sense, as fat, it's not a static store on your body. It's actually an active organ. And so if you stop and consider, if suddenly your liver doubled in size or some other organ doubled in size, you would probably have great disruptions in your metabolism and your health. And so as you gain weight, you're shifting your metabolism because you suddenly have this tissue is not just inert fat sitting on your body. It actually puts out active molecules that can affect the way you metabolize glucose and various other things like that.
Yeah.
So it does have these other effects. So really, obesity is one risk factor in health, but there are other independent ones. But it does have its risk factors as well.
Yeah.
And the caller really wanted to know when. His question was, when are you defined obese? Again, that really needs to be looked at in conjunction with the rest of your life and with your doctor. And it's based on the percent of body fat at some point. If you're just above a certain level, then probably your metabolism had to make some adjustments, and you may want to consider what to do about that.
Yeah. Keeping on the theme of health here for a moment, it's interesting to note that persons who are obese may suffer from malnutrition or undernutrition. First, what's the difference between malnutrition and undernutrition, and how common are these conditions in persons who are obese?
Malnutrition and undernutrition. Malnutrition is just more an extreme form, in a sense. Undernutrition is just you have certain nutrients that you have taken in and in your body, and they're at very minimal levels down it. Often nutrients basically have a minimum level you need to have and a maximum level. It's always important to realize that many nutrients are also toxic. You don't want to necessarily have too much of something or too little of
mm-hmm.
it. Malnutrition means you've clearly gone into deficient states of certain nutrients in that case, and that you're basically eating into your own body stores in there. It is actually fairly common to have obesity associated with undernutrition or poor nutrition, because obesity is basically a measure of the relative amount of energy you've taken in versus the amount you've expended. And all it talks about here now is calories. In other words, it means if you're gaining weight, if you're gaining fat, what it means is that you have eaten more calories than you've expended over a period of time, and that extra energy is being stored as fat. But that says nothing all about your calcium intake or your vitamin C intake or any of the
other
things. Iron, all sorts of things. And there have been some interesting recent studies that shown in obese young children, many of these obese young children end up being iron deficient. So they're getting plenty of calories, but they're actually not getting enough iron in their diet, and they're becoming anemic.
Hmm. So if we're not getting the right mix of vitamins and minerals and other substances that are make up a healthful diet, that can contribute or exacerbate the situation.
Well, it certainly isn't good for health.
Right.
And the situation could be is that you're taking in excess calories, which is, but over the long term, will probably have a compromise to your health. And at the same time, you're taking in a deficit of important things that are needed for your metabolism and your health, and so that's going to be compounding the fact. One of the reasons this has come about is because we manufacture our food. If you look at how in evolution, you know, a sort of appetite for eating is evolved, animals are out in their environment trying to find things that they call food. And it's a remarkable what the diversity can be. But usually, when you're eating something, it has lots of nutrients in it when it's an actual wild food or an actual, if it's a plant or an animal or what have you, you're actually getting lots of nutrients in addition to the energy that's coming in. And it looks like animals are often keying into simply getting enough food, with the basic understanding is if they eat enough of what is their food, they're going to get most of these nutrients coming in. But we're able to simply manufacture foods where we can completely control the nutrient content. We can make it higher in sugar, lower in calcium. We can have vitamin C in it or no vitamin C in it. We can totally change our foods around. And so that we can make foods that we like, that we have an appetite for, that actually in the wild probably would never even exist. And in the wild, foods that we would like probably had lots of all the other nutrients coming along with it. Now you can find a food that has plenty of sugar or plenty of fat and very little iron, very little vitamin C, very little of the other nutrients.
Why do we have an appetite for so many things that are empty in caloric value?
In the past, they wouldn't have been so empty.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another issue, and it's almost basic in an economic situation. You think in economics, there's many things that cause something to be valuable, but one of them would be scarcity. If something is rare, it often becomes valuable, especially if people want it. Okay? In the ancient environment, foods that had lots of easy-to-digest calories, in other words, high in sugar or high in fat, were very rare and often very, very difficult or even dangerous to obtain. They also, though, would give a very large sort of bang for the buck. If one of our ancestors was motivated to try to get it, it might actually have given that person an advantage. So people with a high motivation to go after these rare or chancy foods might have done better than people who didn't have as much of a motivation. But now what we've got now is we have that motivation. So we like sweet things. In the past, that would have been finding honey out of a beehive, which took some work and a little bit of danger to get and wasn't very common. Now, though, we have food companies who look around and say, well, we know what you want. We know what you like. We can now make it. We can make it cheaply. Mm-hmm. We can make it very easy for you to get. You don't have to risk lurking leopards at the waterhole or expending a huge amount of energy to get it. All you have to do is take some money out of your wallet and buy it at the store. So the food industry is giving us what we want. And what we've developed a taste for in the past probably gave an adaptive reward because it was rewarding people who were expending lots of energy and effort to find something that was rare and valuable in the environment.
Yeah. Well, our ancestors were smaller than we are, and they were more active than we are. Mm-hmm. So presumably they didn't need as much food as, well, I don't know. Maybe they needed every bit as much food as we do because we're less active than they were.
Right.
But anyway, here's what I'm trying to get at. What has been the evolutionary benefit of becoming larger?
There are a couple benefits. One is a more abstract one, and that is there is an efficiency advantage to being larger. Okay, if I look at the amount of food I need to live in a day, the basic amount of energy that I would have to take in, if I then looked at two animals that were both half my size, they would actually have to each eat more than half of what I would eat. In other words, as you get bigger, yes, you do need more energy. If you're larger, you actually do have to take in more energy, but it's not one for one. It's at a lower level. So getting larger means that you actually have the increase in extra energy is less than your gain in full size. On the other hand, if you look at your intestinal tract, your stomach and your intestines, they pretty much go up with your body size. So the ability to eat food, so you double in size, or a species, we're talking species now, so one species is twice as big as another one. So a human being now versus an early Australopithecine who might have been half our size, we can eat more food. We have a larger stomach. We can also store more energy on our bodies because we store energy in our muscles, we store energy in fat. And the larger you are, the greater a proportion to your need you can store, which then means you can go longer between eating. So a small animal, I work with some very small monkeys. They're about the size of squirrels, little common marmosets from South America. They probably can't go much more than a day or so without food before starting to be quite compromised. But human beings, as large as we are, we can go quite a long period of time without eating. We may not like it, but we can certainly survive it. And then if you get up to the huge body scales, you talk about whales. There are whales, mother whales, that are lactating, that are nursing and feeding their calves, that fast for an entire month. They don't even eat while they're lactating. But, of course, they're huge, and therefore they're capable of doing that. So that's the sort of abstract advantage to getting bigger.
Mm.
The disadvantage is you actually have to find more food, but you don't have to find as much more, and you can go longer between times. In other words, you can follow a more high-risk strategy of finding a lot of food now and then wait a while and then find more food.
Yeah. Are some of us more susceptible to obesity because of genetic makeup? Jay, you want to take that one?
Yeah, we both looked at each other.
Yeah.
the simple answer is yes,
uh-huh.
but it isn't a simple answer.
It's not a simple answer.
That's the story. That's the story of the evolution of obesity. It's not
right,
a simple
yeah,
story.
That's exactly right.
There are certainly there are genetic conditions that cause people to gain a large amount of fat, and many of them have been identified. But when we look in the population, very, very few people have those. But they do exist. Then, of course, we look around and see that there are large numbers of obese people today, and especially in our country. And there are probably, there are genes that are genetic, and not even genes, it's areas of the genome that seem to associate with people who are more or less likely. But we haven't really been able to identify exactly what they're doing. There certainly is variation amongst people, and that variation can come from a whole set of things, and some of it is going to have to be genetic, and because genetics does underlie the biology at some point, but not all of it is going to be strictly genetic. And at the moment, we haven't been there are no simple answers. You're not going to be able to find, like I say, there's no easy silver bullet
mm-hmm.
to sit there and say, flip this switch, and everybody's going to end up, you know, looking like a professional tennis player.
And I think one of the misleading expectations of the age that we live in is that it would be a simple switch
mm-hmm.
or a simple gene. It's going to be a number of genes interacting with an environment that facilitates some and doesn't others. And so we're a long way from understanding how that works. I mean, there are observations that are out there, but it's not it does not look like anything remotely like one or two or three or four genes being sort of mapped on to obesity. I mean, part of the misleading part of the information molecules, of which leptin, particular hormone that measures fat, and it's a very common thing that's occurred, is that once somebody discovers a particular hormone linked to fat or obesity or leanness, there'd be a one-to-one relationship so that the magic bullet would be found.
Mm-hmm.
There are no magic bullets yet, but there are sets of hormonal signals that are regulating body weight, body fat, body mass, body muscle interacting. And that there's no question about. But for the last 25 years, the exciting part of the last 25 years is the discovery of diverse information molecules, what we call information molecules, like leptin, like cholecystokinin, like ghrelin. That's an ugly word, ghrelin, you know. And they're typically peptides that are produced in cells. They're in the brain and they're in the periphery, like in fat cells or in the duodenum or in the stomach. And they circulate in the body and they regulate end organ systems in the body. And every time one is discovered, and there's a long list, and there's going to be more on that list. Everybody rushes, we found the fat hormone. and so far, now we're going to inject it, and they're going to lose weight. And then they get 30 heavy people, and they inject it, and, but gosh, they didn't lose weight. That doesn't mean that the signals aren't obviously playing a role. They are, but not in that way.
Yeah.
And so that's where we are on that. You want to say something, Mike?
No, our bodies are very complex biological systems.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to get very simple answers out of this. And we're also, if you look at the evolutionary principles, we're ancient. You know, we personally aren't ancient, but the biology we're living with comes from long ago, and many of these signaling systems are extremely ancient. They go back 500 million years ago, these signaling systems were around. And so they often have multiple functions. So when you mention any one particular hormone, it doesn't do one thing in the body. It does hundreds of things in the body in conjunction with the other hormones. So it's a very complex system.
And we like the idea, though, of the magic ghrelin, if I could use that term.
It's a term it's a hormone, ghrelin. Right?
Ghrelin, yeah. We like a simple solution. We like a solution that doesn't take a whole lot of work, and that has also played a role in our success.
Absolutely.
Because we can reserve energy. So it's fascinating. It's interesting to think about.
In many ways, when I look at human endeavor, even in the science and everything, I say some of the things you see tell us more about how the human mind thinks and how the human mind evolved, not so much about how reality actually is. Yes, we do like simple, straightforward solutions. And if you think about our ancestors in the past who are concerned about, should I go down to the water hole now or later, and where are the leopards right now? Simple solutions were probably ones you wanted to get to. You didn't want to get too complex and too, think about it. But that isn't the way that when we actually get into science, when we finally looking at things, you start realizing there's huge complexities there, and our minds may like the simple solution, but they rarely ever end up being the correct solution.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, Mike Power and Jay Shulkin, co-authors of The Evolution of Obesity. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite your questions, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the topics you examine in the book is the concept of the meal. And the meal, you say, has all kinds of connotations. And you've included, as an illustration of this, a photograph of Renoir's Luncheon of the Boating Party. Talk with us, if you would, about the importance of the meal and how we came to the meal and why that's been important to our success.
Yeah, I actually really have a great fondness for that picture. Renoir, I think, was a great artist, and I just happen to think that's just a really just pleasant, wonderful picture to look at. But it also illustrates, I thought very nicely, the other side of human thought about food, that food is not just for nutrition. And when you look at study most other animals eating, animals usually don't eat in the way we do. Human beings are very cooperative about their eating. We are very social about it. And eating suddenly has all sorts of other meanings attached to it. And it's going to be very difficult ever to prove how ancient this adaptation is, how long ago it was that human beings started eating together and sharing food and being restrained about stealing off each other's plates, so to speak. But we think it's a pretty important aspect of the development of the human being as a species, and especially having to do with the development of the human mind, human brain, and our ability to think and to be restrained in a large extent. Usually, I work mostly with non-human primates, and I've done a little bit of work in the field, not much, but when you sit there and watch a monkey moving through the forest and feeding, it pretty much eats what it finds. It finds something, it eats it, goes on to the next, etc. Human beings, we set all these rituals up about feeding. You know, we gather food up and bring it to a particular place, whether we were a hunter-gatherer finding it out in the forest or whether we're going to the grocery store and buying it. We get our food from one place, we bring it to another, and we eat it in another place. And we almost always share it or eat in conjunction with other human beings. And there's usually some sort of connection between those human beings that eat together. And if you sit down and just watch a meal, the next time you're the next time you go to a food court or something and sit down and look around, you'll see this whole collection of human beings sitting down with food on trays and plates and eating and everything, and there's a lot of cooperation, there's a lot of restraint, nobody steals stuff from each other. And I guarantee you, if I did that same thing with a group of these little monkeys that I study, that wouldn't happen that way. They'd be all jumping all over the food and grabbing whatever they could, and it's a very different scenario, because then it would be about the food.
Hmm.
So in the book, I sort of were putting forth the idea that when we look at human evolution, of course, one of the biggest important things of human evolution is how and why did our brain evolve? Why did we end up with this brain that has so much capacity and the ability to do so many different things? And social interactions is clearly a very important part of that. And what we're suggesting is that this shift in type of eating, of being able to gather food from one place, bring it to another, that implies some levels of planning and delayed gratification, and then restraint, the ability to sit down with other members of your group and eat peacefully together, shows a fair amount of restraint. And restraint is usually something associated. This is where you really should step in, Jay, because that's a brain thing, and Jay is our brain guy here. Jay?
Well, I wanted to pick up, no question about that, but I thought the other point that Celeste was making is the other side of having an evolved brain is to use it badly. That is, to think what looks like a simple solution that's not in our best interest.
Yeah.
And that was one of the questions that you raised. And there's no issue. The good side of having a big brain is explore, expand, utilize, conquer the moon. The bad side is an abuse, devolution of function that emerges with having such an evolved cortex or an evolved brain. And that's made very clear, you know, with an obesity epidemic that's to nobody's advantage, healthcare advantage or any other. And sure, we can simplify the food resource such that it's easy to get. It has some of the things we need, but not all. It highlights a predilection for sweet when sweet signals nutrition, not sweet signaling not nutrition, as would be found in nature. And so that's an abuse of our intelligence that also comes with an evolved brain. Restraint is a big part of, a third of the brain is the frontal cortex. Inhibition comes in part through the frontal cortex. You can use it in lots of ways. One of the ways that we don't use it is that there are various forms of addictive behaviors where you're filling up with food a vacuum that's not being filled elsewhere, let alone the idea that we don't exercise the way one might and should, let alone that everything's easy to get without having to expend mm-hmm. energy the way we would, but just the various forms of the abuse that comes with being smart and therefore not being smart.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with the two of you, so let's take another call. This listener is in Bourbonnais on line four. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Would you please discuss the role of supplements and their efficacy?
Supplements are, again, they're a heritage of our modern world and in our brains in that sense, as in that in the past, the foods we were gathering probably contained huge numbers of nutrients and lots of things that weren't nutrients, and so there was a more complexity of what we were eating. Now we can refine things, get things down in there, and in some ways you add back, supplements are effectively an attempt to add back in a way, but they're sort of adding back in that same way. I'm not sure what supplements mean there, but we're talking about vitamins or other things like that. We're able to produce foods that are very simple in their nutrient composition, and then we can add these supplements that we're trying to make a word out of a bunch of letters as opposed to, Jay, just jump in.
There's also a very misleading part to supplements. Consider calcium, right? Calcium is a prototypical supplement. Well, if you can't absorb it, what does it mean to ingest it through a supplement? If you don't have the receptors or the ability to take it in, say, for bone. I mean, I don't think a lot is known about the way the stuff is incorporated into bodily tissue. Now, that's the one that, Mike and I have written a lot about, calcium, all right? But, one of the issues that emerge from the hormone therapy issues is you take a hormone and you think there's a magic bullet, or you take a supplement like calcium and you think it's a magic bullet. Well, if you can't absorb it because you're a certain age, or you're deficient in a certain hormone, or you don't have the receptors for it, well, then what does it mean to take the supplement? That's true for lots of things, all right? And I don't think there's a lot known about the absorption of various supplements. Now, I don't know which one you have in mind.
Well, you're actually getting to what I have in mind, and that is how efficacious are they? And
I think a lot is not known, which shouldn't be that surprising to you. I mean, the one that I think we know a lot about is the calcium story, all right? But I wouldn't be surprised for iron. I wouldn't be surprised for just about every other one, I mean, that I could think of. And then you take all the supplement, you put them in a mixture, let alone giving them separately. Well, how much do we know about how that works?
Right.
And gets in. Then how much is it age dependent?
And it seems like every few months there's a revision in the basic.
Well, that's because there's little known and people are looking for a magic bullet. Again, it's what Celeste said, really. It's the using intelligence maybe misguidedly to always searching for this magic bullet, as opposed to seeing the body as a whole living organ, all right, of which obesity is part of a lifestyle and a self-conception. Now, some people if they have a tumor in the hypothalamus, that's one thing, all right, and they get, but most of the stuff is in this large area of regulation. And how the supplements, whether they're given singly or separate, fit in is really underdetermined.
Let's take one more call this afternoon. A listener in Belgium, Illinois. Line one, hi.
Hello. You started this show talking about obesity and fat and stuff. And here along in this discussion, you've been talking about the use of the brain in diet and stuff. But correct me if I'm wrong, please. Isn't the brain a great deal of fat?
Well, it is. And actually, all the myelin sheath is fat, for the way the neurons fire. I mean, fat's an essential part of end organ systems, of which the brain is one.
I find it interesting that maybe there's some kind of relationship between the two. Since there's so much fat in the brain, maybe that's why we got so much fat on us.
there have been people who bring that up, and basically the statement is that if you look at primates, we have bigger brains than most of the other primates, and there's especially a lot of brain growth in our young. Obviously, a baby is born with a relatively small brain, and it grows a fairly large brain by the time it's 8 or 10 years old. It's pretty much full grown in brain, and yes, that does take a fair amount of fat, but not a huge amount of fat in that sense. Fat is basically being certain fats, and it's not just fat per se. It's certain particular fats that are preferentially being incorporated into membranes in the brain. And that's a very important issue, certainly. It means that you need to have those fats either in your diet or the ability in your body to be able to produce those fats in order to build the brain. But it's not completely clear that how it relates to fat that's stored on the body.
Yeah.
That can be a very different issue. That may have more to do with reproduction in some issues than it does to do with building a brain.
Okay. We've got to wrap up here. Before I have got one last question, I do want to tell our listeners that the National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for extreme western Sangamon County in central Illinois until 2:45 this afternoon. Well, here now to wrap up, and we have to be brief, we've been talking about being smart, using our brains to better
Yep.
our lives.
Yep.
And we can do this at an individual level. What can we do collectively, do you think, to roll back this epidemic, to get ourselves clear of this epidemic of obesity?
Well, one thing in terms of how we approach, you know, our what's called the built environment, our building our communities, and how we live in the world, is the fact that for a fairly sustained period of time now, a lot of our innovation has been going into, you know, almost what we call labor-saving devices, making things easier to be able to move around mechanically,
mm-hmm.
elevators as opposed to stairs, cars versus bicycles and walking. So our evolutionary biology basically puts a premium on good high-density caloric foods, and it also puts a small premium on being lazy. In other words, in the old days, one way not to starve to death was to expend less energy as well. Right. So we've basically built a system where we've taken out the exertion, while at the same time we've added in the ability to get the good food. You know, and if we simply added in the ability to get really good food and yet made it really difficult and you had to climb, you know, 15 flights of stairs every time you wanted to eat, we probably would have a different scenario going on here.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I wanted Jay to jump in and then we got to wrap up.
Okay.
Mike is a fitness guy. He's an ex-athlete. The other side of these fitness guys is they get hurt a lot. And I'm married to an athlete. I think a culture that promotes foods that we would all agree on are in our interest to eat, along with exercise as a way of life, along with channeling out other ways in which to motively express certain basic desires, are the steps in the right direction. We know what it takes, all right, to reduce body weight. We know what it takes to living a healthy lifestyle. Obesity in the modern era is a symptom and a symbol of an aberration that can be corrected.
There, we'll leave it. Jay Shulkin, Michael Power, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Yeah, quite interesting for having us.
The two biologists are the authors together of The Evolution of Obesity. The book is published by the Johns Hopkins Press. It's 1:54. Settlement prices are in from Chicago and Kansas City. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Celeste. The numbers in Chicago on a Wednesday afternoon finished like this for the day. September wheat futures were 4.5 lower. A high today at 480.75 in the soft red winter wheat pit. A low at 457.75 and a settlement price at $4.66. Down 4.5. December 508, the top, the bottom at 485.5. Settled at 493.5, down 4.75. And next year's July wheat futures, a 549.75 high, low at 28.5. Settlement price at 536.25 for the harvest month. July soft red down 4 cents in Chicago. September hard red winter wheat in Kansas City, a $4.97.25 settlement price today, a penny and 1/4 lower. Back in Chicago from the corn pit, the nearby September contract up 5.5 cents today with a top of $3.21.75 a bushel, a bottom at $3.10.25 and a settlement price at $3.20, up 5.5 cents. December futures, $3.29 the high, the low at $3.17.5, settled at $3.27.5, up 5 cents. And March contract, $3.42.75 the high, the low at $3.31.5, settlement price at $3.41.25, 5 cents higher. May futures, $3.51.75 the high, Low at 341.5, settled at 350.5, up 4.75. July corn futures 360.5. The high, the low at 49.5, settled at 359.5. Rather at 359, up 4.5 for the July corn. December at 2010, a $3.77.25 settlement price, up 4.75. From the oat pit, 203.25 unchanged. December unchanged as well at 217. From the soy complex now, September soybean futures $10.05 the high. Low at $9.79.75, settled at $9.97, a penny and a half higher. November contract, the harvest month, $9.67.5, the high, the low at $40.5, settlement price at $9.58, down a penny. And the January futures, $9.72.75, the high, the low at $46.25, settlement price at $9.63, down 1.5. March contract in the bean pit, $9.74.75, the high, the low at 50.75, settled $9.64.75, down 2.25, and November beans 2010, settlement price $9.35, up 3.25. September bean meal, settlement price at $3.16.30, up $2.60. September soybean oil at $36.11, finished 17 cents higher. I'll return in 9 minutes with the closing market report when we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Now let's turn our attention to the livestock contracts. Another lower day today for the contracts that we follow at the Merck in Chicago. August live cattle, 85.10 the high, the low 84.42.5, the settlement 84.82.5, down 12.5. October 89.30 the high, 88.45 the low, the settlement 88.67.5, down 17.5. December 88.90 the high, 88.20 the low, the settlement 88.32.5, down 22.5. February 88.75 the high, 88.15 the low, 88.17.5 the settlement, down 40. August feeder cattle 101.30 the high, 101 even the low, 101.05 the settlement, down 10. September 101.60 the high, $100.90 the low, the settlement 101.15, down 10. October 101.40 the high, $100.80 the low, the settlement 101.20, that down 2.5. November feeder cattle 101.80 the high, 101.15 the low, 101.40 the settlement, down 25. Lean hogs October and December finished higher, February and April finished lower. October lean hogs 46 even the high, the low 43.80, the settlement 45.75, up 122.5. December 44.85 the high, 43.50 the low, 44.62.5 the settlement, up 17.5. February 51.40 the high, 50.20 the low, 51.35 the settlement, down 50. April 56.20 the high, the low 54.90, and the final today, the settlement 55.72.5, down 117.5. And August bellies, 45.50 the high, 43.50 the low, 45.50 the settlement. That was up $2. On Wall Street, the Dow is currently down, that is up in the green. The Dow is up 70 points at 92.88. The NASDAQ is up 14 at 19.70. And the S&P 500 up 8 at 9.97. Nearby crude in New York, trading up $3.23 a barrel at $72.18. It's 2 o'clock. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director is Jason Croft. The National